getting back to the previous question about statement of facts, is there in the record of this case the agreement between Henson and the persons to whom the city sold this road, whatever Hurd, I believe the name was?
Kilman Hurd, Your Honor.
Kilman Hurd. Is that agreement between Henson and Kilman Hurd in the record?
Your Honor, it was an oral contract between the parties. My client just continued to utilize the space after Kilman Hurd became the successor in interest to the city of Laredo. There is in the record a copy of a compromise settlement agreement, and it's got a longer definition than that as far as what the document is titled. This agreement clearly set forth that my clients had a right to the premises, and my clients had a right to be able to turn around and receive payments from Mr. Crow at that time. And they assigned, Kilman Hurd Limited, assigned all interests in that lease space. And what that space was an airport hangar, and it was used as a fixed base operation whereby my clients, when they were utilizing it to operate and service aircraft. Mr. Crow turned around and utilized it for an operation where I believe he was servicing his coal trucks and was using it to maintain his coal trucks.
Is all this in the record in the stipulation of facts?
Findings of fact, Your Honor.
They are?
Yeah, there is in the record, and because it's statement of facts, absence of statement of facts is a primary issue in this case. Now, in the record, you're stating to us there is evidence that Kilman Hurd and Henson agreed that Henson had the right to sublease this to Crow.
Yes, sir.
And that would be contrary to any assertion supposedly made that Henson's contract with the city of Laredo, was that the same? Had been breached by the city.
That's correct.
Isn't that the essence of the case?
Primarily, Your Honor. This issue was decided by the trial court, and the trial court ruled in its judgment against my clients. They, in turn, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law submitted by opposing counsel to the court, also added one other requirement as far as the finding of law, and that was the estate of Bruce L. Crow was not a proper entity to be sued. To address that issue, we were notified approximately 1 month after the trial that Mr. Crow had died. At that time, we filed a writ of sure fascis, and that was filed on September 20th, 1985. The defendant filed his suggestion of death on October 14, 1985. This case went to trial on October 21st, so it was less than a week before trial, before we were ever notified of who the administrator was. On that same day, being October 14, 1985.
Is that in the record?
I believe, Your Honor, these dates are in the Court of Appeals opinion, and I think it is in the record, if I'm not mistaken.
See, we're bound by this record.
I understand, Your Honor. On October 14th, well, we went to trial on that time, and the estate had been named a party. The estate had been answered by Mr. Hall, and at that time we had gone on at trial, and on the trial amendments that they had filed, which is a party record, being their third amended answer, they pled no affirmative defense, stating that there was not a proper party before the court, and under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 9, also any defects in pleadings not brought to the attention of the court prior to the judgment being rendered are deemed to be waived. I wanted to address that issue, and there's also the cases that I cited, Atkins versus Horn and Houston TCR Company versus Buchanan. Both of these cases dealt with the fact where an administrator had come in and had answered not on behalf of the estate, had assumed and adopted the pleadings of the individual prior to his death. And the court said that it would be basically a travesty for the administrator not to be able to have adopted, even if he hasn't done so expressly. There's also a case that was not cited. It's Fleming Oil versus Watts, 193 Southwest 2nd 979. There's a case case out of civil appeals in Texarkana, 1946.
What was that site again?
Your Honor, it's 193 Southwest 2nd, 979.
Fleming versus what?
Fleming Oil Company versus Watch. In that case, it dealt with two parents who were filing suit against Fleming Oil Company for the wrongful death and personal injuries that had been received by their children. And on that, there was no administration intending. They filed it individually and on behalf of their children. The court stated that in that case, since Fleming Oil Company, under Rule 90, failed to bring to the attention of the court before the judgment that they deemed that the matters had been waived by the pleas.
So okay, let's get back to the facts of this case now. On October the 15th,
was October 14th.
October 14th, a notice of death had been filed.
Suggestion of death had been filed.
And October 21st, he went to trial.
That's correct.
When was the objection that the proper party was not before the court filed?
Your Honor, the first time that was ever mentioned was in the findings and facts and conclusions of law that were submitted by the court on May 27, 1986. The judgment had been rendered on April 16, 1986.
Who filed the suggestion of death?
Mr. Hall did, on behalf of the respondent.
Did Mr. Hall appear as attorney for the Crow Estate or appear as an object attorney in the trial?
Yes. He had filed his answer on behalf of the estate of Louis L. Crow. That was the first time.
Oh, wait, he filed an answer on behalf of the estate of Bruce L. Crow.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did mention the administrator?
Did not mention an administrator at that time.
Okay.
We feel that under Rule 90 and Rule 94 that he waived any type of defects or any type of affirmative defenses in that matter. And by failing to bring that to the court's attention before the judgment had been rendered, he waived that, but the administrator is bound by the actions of Mr. Hall and their counsel. The second point of error, which I would like to address, is the issue of judicial estoppels. This doctrine was adopted in first in Tennessee, and then our court, in Texas Supreme Court in Long versus Knox in 1956, adopted that case. In fact, I can read briefly, I think it's very pertinent because this is the key case in which all our cases of judicial estoppel have arisen. States, the doctrine of judicial estoppel is not strictly speaking estoppel at all, but arises from positive rules of procedure based on justice and sound public policy. It is to be distinguished from equitable estoppel based on inconsistency in judicial proceedings because the elements of reliance and injury essential to equitable estoppel need not be present. Under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, as distinguished from equitable estoppel by inconsistency, a party is estopped merely by the fact of having alleged or admitted in his pleading in a former proceeding under oath the contrary to the assertion sought to be made. What we have done, Your Honor, I believe in our briefs, has addressed three elements that the courts have found without question that comprise judicial estoppel. The first element is that a prior inconsistent statement made in a judicial proceeding under oath. The courts have even further defined that as even requiring that all of the inconsistent statements in the previous case must be on plea, some type of a sworn, either answer or original petition, and in some cases, request for admissions, which is a pleading also, they have found that. The cases which we have cited were Metro Plot versus Schaefer, Moore versus Nett, Long versus Knox, Johnson Service Company versus Transamerica Inc., a case out of the Fifth Circuit. And the case not cited was Vindig versus Kraler, case 604 Southwest 2nd, 424, case out of Dallas. All of these cases specifically recognize that any type of inconsistent prior statement must have been made in a pleading. Your Honor, I think that there's quite a few policy arguments in that regard that should be relevant in this case, and that a statement made in a deposition, unfortunately, sometimes are not well thought out, or a statement set forth in that some type of an answer being prepared by an attorney, usually very carefully worded and considered. Additionally, depositions can be amended, and at trial they can also be clarified if possible. In this case, the first case never did go to trial. The case was settled out of court. It was considered a wash when my clients in turn sold their claim and interest in their property at the old Laredo Mines Airport to Tillman Herd Limited. The case decided by the respondent in this are Aetna Life Insurance versus Wells. This case went on to the Supreme Court and was affirmed there. That case specifically set out that there could be depositions and affidavits, how the Supreme Court, I believe this court, ruled on that fact and specifically addressed that issue. Aetna, however, did cite the case of Turcotte versus Trevino, which that case specifically, and it's holding in the citation, which this court uses in Turcotte, required a pleading. The other case cited by the respondent is Van Dusen versus Connecticut General Life Insurance. That case specifically cites out various Texas cases in which all of them require the pleading to be in effect rather than some type of a deposition or other oral statement under oath. Van Dusen cites for its, I guess, its point of law in that area on the Tennessee cases, which were primarily enacted, I believe, by the Tennessee courts after Long versus Knox was entered by the Supreme Court here. Other cases are Yarbrough versus Pinnell, which the respondent also cites. That case cites Long versus Knox as its principle of law in dealing, and in that case it dealt with specifically sworn pleadings and also with answers to requests for admissions.
Before you go much further, why in the world can a state be a party? Although the opinion in the state is not a party, it has to be a personal representative of the estate. And all we have through here is the estate of us, the estate of.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there are a long line of cases that
there is a long line of cases, but the cases which we have cited in our brief also state for the administrator to come in and go to trial on the pleadings when the administrator is not named. He's barred by that.
But how can the estate of Bruce Crowe be a party to anything?
Your Honor, at that time, that was the answer filed by the respondent in the case. He went to trial on as the estate of Bruce L. Crowe. And for him to come in and say that the estate is not bound because the administrator was not named, this was less than 7 days prior to trial.
My question to you, how can the estate of Bruce Crowe ever be a party to anything?
Your Honor, the estate can only act by and through its administrator.
The personal representative?
Personal representative. That was the cases that I have cited to the court in my brief. I specifically state that when a personal representative is not named in the lawsuit, that should not prevent the case from going forward, and any results are binding upon the estate and the administrator, as though he had answered specifically and expressly to the court. Point number two of the elements of the judicial estoppel require that the prior position must have been successfully adjudicated. In this case, the prior case, Juan Martinez and Douglas O. Hinton versus the City of Laredo, was never finally adjudicated. The court has before it the settlement document between my client, Douglas O. Hinton, and Tillman Herd Limited. There's no question about that. It clearly sets out that there was no final adjudication, and it's not inconsistent with the position that was taken in this lawsuit against Mr. Crowe. cases which we have cited, Moore versus Neff, case by the Supreme Court, and Bocanegra versus Aetna Life Insurance, Long versus Knox, all require that the successful adjudication, and then whereby the party who sought to be estopped comes in and tries to assert a different position. In this case, we're not trying to assert a different position. We're trying to assert the same position that we took in the previous lawsuit, and which is clearly set forth in that settlement document. The third position as far as, or the third element is the prior inconsistent statement not made by inadvertent mistake, fraud, or duress. In the case of cited, Johnson Service Company, Metro Flight again, Moore versus Neff, and a Tennessee case, D.M. Rose and Company versus Snyder. Your Honor, furthermore, there's a fourth element which some of the courts have found. Smith versus Chipley, Eggers versus Hinckley, and Page Airways, Inc. versus Associated Radio. There was a fourth element that required the party seeking to invoke judicial estoppel must have been adverse in the former suit. There's no question that Bruce L. Pro, the estate of Bruce L. Pro, Brian Drew, its administrator, was not a party to the former suit. He came in as a sublessee to my clients. My clients had the original lease with the city of Laredo. They, in turn, subleased the premises directly to Bruce L. Pro under an oral contract. The third point of error which we have brought to this court is that the sublessee cannot assert defenses available only to the lessor. Case of Nelson versus Seidel, Ewing versus Moran, Casco versus Johnson, all found that the rights of the lessor to come in and when there has been a contract that specifically states you cannot come in and sublease, such as in our case, it required that in the contract. And also the statute of Article 5237 requires that the lessor can waive that defense in the contract. The lessor can go in there and he's the only one that can assert it. The sublessee has no grounds in which to assert any type of affirmative defense that there has been some type of material interference with the right of possession or in some ways that the lease has been breached with respect to the invalidity of that subleasing. In conclusion, we ask that the court render its judgment in the amount found by the trial court and the finding of fact in the sum of $32,844 for the 42 months rent plus the utilities, which the court found to be in the sum of $1,344.44 plus the attorney's fees as set forth therein. And we would respectfully request that the court not reverse and remand this case, but reverse and remand.
Counsel, in that connection, the Court of Appeals opinion states that they refused to address the second point of error. What was that point?
Your Honor, I believe the second point of error, if I'm not mistaken, was the issue as far as the estate of Bruce L. Pro not being a legal entity. I believe the third point of error was with the material interference with the lease, and whether or not the sublessee could assert any type of...
Did that have to do with factual sufficiency?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, that's your point of error, was it not?
Your Honor, I don't recall. No.
Thank you.
Mr. Hall, this is an argument to the respondent.
Please, court. The only ruling by the Court of Appeals in this case was in effect that prior deposition testimony may be the basis for judicial estoppel. And I submit that's the only question of law before this court, the correctness of the Court of Appeals ruling. The issue is pretty simple. May prior deposition testimony never be the subject of judicial estoppel? There are case authorities, Texas cases, not Supreme Court, that suggests the doctrine should be limited to prior sworn pleadings, usually citing language of Long versus Knox, which dealt with, in that case, on the facts, a prior sworn pleading, adjunctive relief.
Why did you think the Court of Appeals phrased its portion of the opinion in such an awkward manner? I got out of it, they say that they don't believe that a matter of law, a deposition, may never be the basis of judicial estoppel.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's kind of a double negative type phrasing there.
And I reason to that, Your Honor, the constraint the Court of Appeals felt because of lack of record performance, the statement of fact, is imperative to the prior deposition testimony. They have before them only the very narrow issue this Court has asked to make. Is the doctrine limited to prior sworn pleadings, or should it be embraced to any prior position under oath, whether it's by affidavit or deposition or pleadings or whatever? There's case authority in Texas that does that. There are Court of Appeals and Courts of Appeals opinions in Texas, cited in my brief as well as by opposing counsel, that have decided the case on prior deposition testimony. Position asserted in it as being contrary to that asserted at the time of trial. There are a number of cases which confuse different remedies, such as the election of remedies doctrine. That requires successful outcome prior proceeding. That's not part of judicial estoppel. There are some cases that deal with pure estoppel. The fourth element co-counsel referred to, I submit, if you look at those cases, are dealing with pure estoppel, where you have the same parties in both prior and subsequent cases. I submit the better reasoned cases do consider that substance should prevail over form, that the basis of the doctrine is the sanctity of an oath. And it doesn't matter and should not be any distinction made that it was in an affidavit or in a deposition or in a plea. The comparison is made to testimony at time of trial, the position asserted at trial in live testimony. It doesn't have to be live. Our rules of procedure would allow that position to be asserted by deposition testimony. So you can have depositions at one end, why can't you have it at the other? There is the safety valve to the imposition, and I recognize it is a harsh one, of this doctrine, by the requirement that the prior position asserted under oath be clear and unequivocal, not be shown to be a result of fraud, mistake, or whatever. I submit, Your Honors, that the extension of the doctrine is consistent as well with the jurisdiction from which we borrow it, the courts of Tennessee. Long versus Knox really does not exhaustively deal with the doctrine. In a way, it's almost an offhand embrasure of cases following it. And I submit this opportunity for this court. Have the opportunity to set clear what is meant by this doctrine. And if we follow the courts of Tennessee, I've cited in my brief relatively recent cases. But if you read the language in them, they are citing a long-standing rule to the effect that prior position asserted under oath, whether it be by affidavit or by deposition or by pleading, can be the basis for imposition of the doctrine. I submit that's dispositive of the case because of the lack of statement of facts before this court. The Court of Appeals was constrained to go no further than to decide that question of law. Can prior deposition be the basis of the doctrine? One is not able to make the comparison that the trial court did. We don't have before us what the trial court heard and considered the plaintiff's position at time of trial through the testimony of Mr. Douglas Henson.
Do you represent the estate of Bruce L. Crowe? Is that your client, the estate of Bruce L. Crowe?
Yes, sir.
Is that a legal entity?
I submit it's not, Your Honor, and I will get to that point briefly.
If it's not a legal entity, what do we have up here?
I'm not sure. And with all due candor, I kind of lost sight of the forest for the trees at the trial of this matter. There was a suggestion of death filed, which nominated the representative of the estate and identified it by name and
was it a temporary administrator appointed?
It was an independent executive.
Was the independent executor then sued, or is it part of this lawsuit?
I submit they're not.
Did they participate in the trial?
That
we don't have
is a valid question.
Did they make an appearance or an impact?
The case authority cited by opposing counsel for an appearance by a representative all deal with a physical appearance in which an individual comes forth and substitutes there's some pleading filed as a substitute.
Well, Mr. Hall, now, are you contending that you, as an attorney at law, can file an answer on behalf of an estate, appear at trial, try the lawsuit, and then say, oh, I didn't mean it, Judge? Isn't that what we have here?
Your Honor, I submit I'm not too proud of it. And it's not something, though, which occurred to me before trial.
Well, aren't the rules set up, though, to provide for that if you don't? If you appear and conduct a trial and make no objection, then you waive.
Well, but if there's not a legal innocence, and you weren't, were you representing the independent executor? Had he been appointed? Were you representing him? Is there anything in the record that you represented the independent executor?
Aside from the filing of suggestion of death, which nominated the independent executor, there's no appearance in the
record. Do we have anything in this record that an independent executor has ever been appointed?
No, Your Honor. First time the name appears in the petition for writ of application.
Back up with me on this point, because I'm having trouble remembering what little law I ever did know on. Once you file a suggestion of death, is that a shifting of the burden to the opposing party to properly name an amended pleading the executor or the administrator?
Your Honor, I'm not...
Let me put a question mark on the end of it, because I'm not sure I know what the law is.
My understanding is it's to cause to appear in a sense, but then it is up to the suing party to amend and pursue the claim against the private party, the representative of the state.
Now, if that's true, and I'm inclined to think that is the law, getting back to Justice Wallace's question, upon their failure to name the proper defendant in the lawsuit, but upon your failure to call that matter to the attention of the court, is the complaint waived?
It depends on whether you consider it fundamental, whether it can be waived or not. I submit today the only thing considered fundamental error anymore is jurisdiction.
Without a legal entity, how can it be anything?
Well, I got us into this fix, and I'm all due candor, I'm not too proud of it, but it just didn't occur to me before trial. And it was submitted in the proposed finding of fact, conclusion of the law to the trial court, and the trial court embraced it. And I'm not really too sure where that leads. And I don't have an answer for it. I submit if you do consider it waived, there are questions about the flexibility of the judge against him. Do you consider the independent executive to have appeared through my person and representation of the estate?
Of course, my question is, how do we even know it was an independent executive?
Well, I had suggested to the Court of Appeals that they request a supplemental transcript to bring up the suggestion of death, and they did not consider that necessary because they decided the case on the judicial estoppel issue. It was not brought up in the record.
All right.
Have you finished with your judicial stuff, Larry?
Well, in essence, I would simply submit that the presumption is in favor of the trial court's findings.
Well, then there also a requirement that you prove that the statement was made, and in this case you're asserting that it can be made a deposition, and also that the party making that statement prevailed in the trial court on that. And on that theory.
No, Your Honor, I submit that's a confusion of the doctrine of judicial estoppel with the election of remedies.
Are you arguing then your policy is that two parties go into court on a bitterly fought construction of a contract? Party A argues just as strongly and he testifies this was the meaning of that contract and the court finds otherwise. He finds the contract is to the opposite. Are you telling me that if the other side breaches the contract, then later on that the court has found that this man cannot come back in and sue under that contract just because he argued that it should be interpreted another way before, In other words, you take one side of an argument, then you lose any benefits you have out of the other interpretation in the subsequent lawsuit. Does that follow? If you, unless you require that the party must prevail on the statement that's made, that's being used as judicial estoppel.
Your Honor, there are cases which have reached that result without considering the outcome of the prior lawsuit.
Well,
because the doctrine is based on the sanctity of the oath, that a person should not be heard to come in court and swear before that court one position. And the prior position, in this case, was no lease. And then come into court and swear to that court. There is a lease. That offends the dignity of the court to have that facility of testimony presented to you, regardless of the fact. That is the policy behind the doctrine. And that is the application that was made in this case by the trial court.
In other words, you're saying the only thing that's necessary for judicial estoppel is to make us in favor. That's the only requirement.
As
contrary to what you're asserting in the prior and a subsequent lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor. That's my understanding of the essence of the doctrine as we borrowed it.
And you think that's what Knox says?
Pardon?
You think that's what Knox says?
Yes, Your Honor. Although, you know, I admit there's some bothersome language in there that seems to it mentions the outcome in the prior lawsuit, but I submit that's not dispositive of the ruling. And as it's been interpreted and followed by other courts in Texas, and if you read the courts of Tennessee, they do not read into that. It's confusion of the election of remedies doctrine to require them, with all due respect. It's a very narrow doctrine, a bit arcane, and I doubt it'll come up for y'all again. Be surprised if it did.
Let me pick up on Judge Wallace's question. Are you contending that if A says contract, B says no contract, the court says there is a contract, that A cannot come back and sue for breach of contract? Is that your position? Because he took a contrary position when the matter was being litigated?
It's my understanding of the application of the doctrine.
That would be the result.
It is the position asserted under oath, which is invocational of the doctrine.
So therefore, you give up your right to sue for breach of contract once the court has found a contract. Is that your argument?
Well, I have problems with that too, because I'm not so sure it's that simple. Your Honor, now. Yes, because if the facility of sworn testimony, should we recognize that someone can come in court and swear, I have no lease, and then turn around and pursue someone else and say, I have a lease? Should we condone that activity, regardless of the fact that...
Let's take this a little further. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the settlement agreement between Killam Hurd and Henson is in the record?
It was offered at trial. I think it was brought up to the court of appeal.
Okay.
That's not the basis for the prior position.
Well, in this case, in the record shows that Henson has from Killam Hurd leased on that facility, and he subleased it to Crow.
Your Honor, I vigorously oppose that shows what counsel said it shows. There is nothing in the record. Was nothing at the time of trial that showed Killam and Hurd agreed that Henson had the right to lease.
No, I'm not talking about that. It's not that he agreed that they had the right, but they, Killam Hurd, leased to Henson. Do you agree that's in the record, in that settlement agreement between them?
It's not in the settlement agreement, but it is in the record. I brought up the deposition of Radcliffe, Killam, and of Bruce Crow.
Okay, it's in the record that they leased to Henson.
Killam Hurd, yes.
Okay, and then Henson turned around and leased to Crow.
No, Your Honor, it's the other way around. Bruce Crow approached Mr. Henson about using his facility that the old airport after closed.
Well, whether it was lease, he let him use it. Is that in controversy?
Yes, Your Honor.
That Crow was using under Henson?
His use of the leased property was interfered with by Kilman Hurd, who exacted a subsequent lease from him for using substantially the same property. That's why he never paid Bruce Crew. He paid Kilman Hurd to use what he thought he rented from Bruce Crew. I mean, from, I'm sorry, from Mr. Henson. I have problems arguing the facts of the case. What's been called the third point of error was actually a cross point, a counterpoint, which I had raised to the Court of Appeals, which was not addressed by the Court of Appeals in any shape, form, or fashion. And it requires a review of what little factual record there was and consideration of questions of fact, not just questions of law. As far as the standing of Bruce Crow to complain of the lack of consideration for the lease, or a lease between him and the
firm. Well, that's the point I was making in the first place. And that would be judicial estoppel. Henson was contending that he had the lease from Kilman Hurd. That was his contention, wasn't it?
That he had the right to sublease based on that lease, not with Kilman Hurd, but with the city of Laredo, to whom Kilman Hurd fell heir when they bought the property.
Well, back to this settlement agreement between Kilman Hurd and Henson. Does that settlement agreement not state that Kilman Hurd is assigning to Henson or their the use of this property, let's put it that way, try to get away from this written lease or oil agreement or whatever we've got?
No, Your Honor, the settlement agreement was that Kilman Hurd bought the improvement that Henson had put on the premises of Hammond. And then there's a lot of self-serving language that we're all familiar with that said that if we have any cause of action or any rights, we're assigning them to you and they've assigned them to us. It doesn't say they had it. It's just usual settlement. Henson received consideration for selling his hand, and he left. And Kilman Hurd continued to have an arrangement with Bruce Crow under a separate lease for use of the premises. And that's substantiated by the deposition of Kilman and of Bruce Crow's charge as part of the record. I understand the court's concern, and I'm not particularly proud of this case. I submit the outcome is correct, but you have problems putting your finger on one, simply because of the lack of a record before you. I submit to be, if you have any question about the facts of the case, it would be appropriate to remand it to the Court of Appeals to consider the only factual issue. Material interference with the right of enjoyment of the premises and standing to complain of the lack of consideration for the sublease. I submit, however, it would be more appropriate still to simply set aside the order granting the writ, the application, that there's not enough of a record to really get a handle on in this case, that the petitioner has not met their basic burden to bring forward sufficient record to demonstrate the error. No matter what point you look at, whether it's judicial estoppel or the state or some material issue, you run up against a procedural problem that you don't have something you need to look at. It's not there. The Court of Appeals had before it only one issue they could get their hands on, made prior deposition testimony on the basis of judicial estoppel. I submit that was correctly decided, that to the extent they could review the record, and I submit that the trial court judgment should be left.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd first like to address some of the points that opposing counsel has raised concerning the judicial estoppel and the statements that have been made, what is before the court.
Counselor, could I interrupt you here on this?
Yes, sir.
I think more important to the court, we can read those cases pretty easy.
I wasn't going to read the cases.
You cited your cases, and I think we narrowed it down. It's a question of what are the essentials of judicial estoppel. But what bothers me, and I think the other members of the court more than that, are what are the facts around here and what's in the record. Now, exactly you tell us what that settlement agreement between Henson and Phil and Heard say?
Your Honor, it's part
you
of
have
the
a copy of it, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Tell us what it says.
Part of the transcript, page 157, beginning on page 157, on the second page of that settlement agreement, and the document is entitled Agreement for Purchase of All Leasehold Improvements and Compromise and Settlement of All Claims by and between Kilman Heard Limited, successor to the City of Laredo, and D.O. Henson and International Aero Enterprises, Inc., Texas Corporation. Second page of that document begins, Henson and or International Aero have continued through this day to claim a right to possession of the premises covered by the FBO lease as amended. While all such claims are released and extinguished, effective as of the day hereof, K&H Limited hereby assigns and releases unto Henson and International Aero any and all claims which it might have for rentals due it as successor to the City of Laredo for the occupancy of the land. The very first sentence says that my clients have not been.
Let me tap them for you.
This one.
Was that one there?
That's okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Crowe, which is on record too. I believe it's on the